Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com, as well as on HD Radio. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish-American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Hope you all had a good week, folks. We had another busy week here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. We had Dr. Emmett O'Connor here on Thursday night speaking about Big Jim Larkin, and we hope to have a chat with Dr. O'Connor. We also started Irish Film New York last night, our annual event now where we collaborate with Niall McKay, the wonderful curator of this film series. And later on in the programme, my colleague Anne Solari will come in and have a chat to us about what to expect at Irish Film New York later today and tomorrow, and over the rest of the month of October. We're already into the second semester of the fall 2014 programming. We're also delighted to have an opportunity to sit down with world-renowned musician, ethnomusicologist, Professor Mick Maloney, who is on faculty here with us at Glucksman Ireland House. Mick is going to fill us in a little bit on some of the projects he's been working on over the past year or so. He was on sabbatical last year from us, so he's a lot to update us on, and we're looking forward to having a chat to Mick about all that. I'm here with my colleague Anne Solari. I can't believe we're into October already, folks, but we are. The first month of the semester is already over, and it was action-packed here at Glucksman Ireland House. And as I look at our calendar of events for October, it looks like it's equally packed with an eclectic mix of events. Thanks, Anne, for taking the time to be with us today. I know you're frantically getting ready for Irish Film New York, the second night of which is tonight. Tell me a little bit more about what's going on this evening.
The big news is the fact that Jim Sheridan's coming to us. It was a real coup to have him come over from Ireland, especially for this festival. And he has such a reputation for dynamic and exciting Q&As, so I think it's going to be a great event. It's tonight at 7 p.m. at NYU's Cantor Film Center, which is on 8th Street between University Place and Mercer Street, just around the corner from Glucksman Ireland House. And they're doing an interview Q&A with him for about 40 minutes, and then we're jumping into a screening of In America, which is one of my favorites.
But that's not the start of the day. If people are interested today, right, they can come along to Cantor for more insight into Jim Sheridan's work and another filmmaker.
Oh, yes. We actually kicked things off earlier in the day with a screening of My Left Foot at 1 p.m. It's the 25th anniversary of its release, which is a great occasion. It starts at 1 p.m. at Cantor Film Center. And then we continue on at 3:30 p.m. We're showing In the Name of the Father, which is another favorite. And then from there, we actually have a non-Jim Sheridan film. We have a new film at 6 p.m. called Love Eternal, which is directed by Brendan Muldowney, and it's having its New York premiere.
And then people can hang around for this evening then at 7, the talk back with Jim Sheridan, right, and the film then right after.
Right, that all starts at 7, so that'll take us through the end of the evening. And then we pick back up again tomorrow. We start at 3 p.m. on Sunday, October 5th, with another new film called Broken Song. And then at 5 p.m. we have Poison Pen, and at 7 p.m. Out of Here.
Wow, so it's a pretty full schedule for all you film buffs out there. Go to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU website or Irish Film New York if you'd like to get tickets. Or if you want to take a chance and turn up, the tickets are going fast, but it's certainly worth taking a chance and coming down as well. And we'll try and squeeze you into NYU's Cantor Film Center. As Anne said, it's at 36 East 8th Street there between University Place and Broadway. So when we're finished with Things Film this weekend, we're looking forward to a great event next Thursday night.
There's a ton of buzz around Matt Thomas's new book, We Are Not Ourselves. It has stellar reviews. He's been on Leonard Lopate and other media outlets. And so there's just a huge interest in this novel. It's about an Irish-American family making their way through the American century, as they say, but it really is in the tradition of Alice McDermott's work. Matt is one of Alice's MFA students. It's a beautiful work, and I feel like you see Alice's influence there. And
absolutely. So moving on to Things History then in the middle of the month, Anne, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, on Thursday, October 16th at 7 p.m., we have Professor Ian McBride coming in from King's College London. The title of the lecture is The Historian as Healer? Dealing with the Past in Northern Ireland. And what he's really doing is looking at Northern Ireland and how history itself can be problematic. History as the way that you look back on the past. It's looking at political stability in Northern Ireland.
Then moving on to Things Music, on the 18th of October, I see we've Mick Maloney coming in to our faculty member. Tell us about what Mick's going to do for us.
Well, your audience members may remember Masters of New York Trad from last year as part of TradFest, which is organized by Tony DeMarco and friends. And so Mick, one of our most popular and valued faculty members, is coming in to lead this panel discussion, and he'll be joined by Dylan Foley, the famed fiddler, Donnie Golden, everyone's favorite dance teacher, and Joni Madden, the famous flutist. I think that'll be a really fun event, and I think people will learn a lot from it.
That's at 1 p.m. on Saturday, October 18th, right?
Yes, it's one of our rare kind of Saturday afternoon events instead of a Thursday. So yes, that's October 18th at 1.
Now, I see on our first open house for our master's program will take place on Friday, the 24th of October from 5 to 7 p.m. I think it's fair to say that this is a great opportunity for people to learn about the program, the Masters of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies that is offered out of Glucksman Ireland House, and the scholarships and logistics involved in applying to the program.
I think one of the big draws is also that you get to meet some of our current students, alumni, and faculty who really bring a face to the MA and demonstrate how it's both accessible and also affordable and also a really interesting intellectual endeavor for people who are looking to continue their education.
As always, Anne, you've done a great job of coinciding our MA open house with the Blarney Star concert that evening on October 24th. Again, that will start at 8 p.m. Tell us a little bit about who's up that evening.
The Blarney Star concert series really stands on its own as always having great bookings. And Don Mead's organized for Damien Connolly to come in. He's both a fiddler and a button accordionist, which is a bit of a rare skill to master both instruments. And so he's always a popular draw, and I think people will have a lot of fun if they come out on Friday, October 24th at 8 p.m.
That's great, Anne. One other event that I would like to draw our listeners' attention to is an event that will take place on Tuesday evening, October 7th at 7 p.m. Anne Cadwallader, the famous British journalist, will be here from the Pat Finucan Centre to launch her new book, Lethal Allies. That will take place at 19 West 4th Street, room 101, at 7 p.m. Glucksman Ireland House is really delighted to be collaborating with the Brehon Law Society in hosting this acclaimed writer on the NYU campus, and we look forward to seeing some of you there. Thanks for coming in today, Anne. I know you're busy, but hopefully in a few weeks' time you might come in again and have a chat to us about what will be on for the rest of the semester.
Oh, that'd be great.
Anyone who wants to find out more information can go to our website and just do a Google search of Glucksman Ireland House events, right?
Absolutely. And if people are interested in coming to several of these events, they might consider becoming members of Glucksman Ireland House. For a flat fee, you can get into almost all the events for free. And when you can't get in for free, we've got some great discount tickets. And it's good for a calendar year.
That's great. Do think about membership. It's a great investment for a really nominal fee. There's a fantastic array of public events in the fall and spring semester, and typically we invite you downstairs for a glass of wine to have a chat about the event right after, so it's always very hospitable and open, and we'd encourage everyone to consider joining Glucksman Ireland House and contributing to what we do here, enlightening or widening our understanding of the Irish experience in the United States. Thanks again, Anne.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Okay, Mick, it's great to have you here today. Thanks for taking the time out this morning to come in and have a chat to us. You were on sabbatical last year, I believe, working on your book and other projects.
I was. I ran around quite a bit, everywhere from the Hebrides in Ireland to Myanmar, Burma, Vietnam, Thailand. And I've all sorts of little projects there, but I really wanted to clear the air and get a bit of time away from telephones and students to write the book. And it's been 20 years in the making. It's the story of Irish music in America. You'd need a wheelbarrow to carry it around. It's 814 pages. And now I'm at the footnote stage, luckily.
Wow.
A done deal. But it's funny how time passes. You wouldn't feel a year going by.
And how close to publication are you with it, Mick?
I would say the middle of next year.
Right.
Two publishers are competing for that. But it'll probably sell well because Irish music is so much on the radar these days. Mm-hmm. When I started out doing this book, it wasn't. And the trouble is I got distracted so much over the year writing. I've written thousands of pages of liner notes for CDs and LPs before that. It's like the forgotten genre.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could have somehow put them all together, the book would have been done years ago, you know.
Tell us about the other things you were working on then while you were away.
Well, I work with Irish Aid, and it happened accidentally some years back. I was touring Vietnam with Peter Yarrow, as in Puff the Magic Dragon, Peter, mm-hmm. Paul and Mary Yarrow. And what he was doing is putting his money and his time where his mouth was. He was a very anti-Vietnam War activist and has been going back periodically to, in a sense, apologize for the war, the most horrifying war, and the long-term effects of the war, particularly unexploded bombs, like Laos is covered with them, and people get their legs blown off every day. And also Agent Orange, which is that defoliant, and it has a chemical called dioxin, which is in the environment, is not water soluble. It's going to take 300 years to clean up.
Wow.
And scientists are there, and to be fair, American scientists among them. And Irish Aid contributes, I think it spends about 28 million euros a year in helping the children who are born with disabilities, possibly and most probably in certain places in the country as a result of Agent Orange. Their spinal deformities, born without arms, without legs sometimes, and hideously deformed heads.
Mm-hmm.
And even in a country where the extended family rules, these kids cannot be taken care of at home. So their institutions and Irish Aid helps them. What we do, the bunch of musicians I bring in, we go a few times a year and we do concerts, we do fundraisers, we do national TV appearances, and we more or less spread the word that, no, you're not forgotten. People do care.
How did you get involved with Irish Aid in the first place?
Because I was touring with Peter Yarrow. The Irish Embassy had just opened up in Vietnam, and Irish Aid, which previously had been restricted just to Africa, had its only station in Asia, which opened up in conjunction with the embassy. So there wasn't the usual quid pro quo with an embassy of trade and the expectation of developing commerce and looking after nationals abroad, which is part of the deal, but the primary thrust was aid. Was giving it. This was when the Celtic Tiger was still sort of in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And they came along to one of the concerts and said, wouldn't it be great if we could team up? Because music opens so many doors.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if they're looking for recognition or fundraising and they give a paragraph about their work, it'll be in page 18 of some business section. If we do a concert on national TV,
mm-hmm.
and it's on front page. And Ireland is very big in the radar in Vietnam because Ho Chi Minh was a huge fan of Michael Collins.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And the Irish Revolution inspired two great revolutions in Asia, Vietnam and Burma. And the general currently in charge in Burma is very familiar with Irish revolutionary history. It's part of their study.
Wow.
Because we were the first country, or the first colonized entity, to rely on guerrilla warfare. And we developed the strategies for it. And Ireland's very popular in places like Myanmar and Burma. Now, in places like Thailand, they think Ireland's Iceland.
Right.
So the new ambassador there, Brendan Rogers, he's again using music as a calling card and the arts. You know, here's who we are. And it's a nice way to introduce, because of the fact we've no imperial history, that helps too. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved in one project after another. Got involved with working with kids with AIDS in the slums of Bangkok, run by Father Joe Meyer, Irish-American priest. And it's a magnificent enterprise. Chuck Feeney, the great philanthropist, was involved in helping. I got to know Chuck very well through that. And a wonderful woman, a nun called Sister Louise Horgan, who's in her 80s from County Cork, who was part of the Good Shepherd ministry, but she was never at home when all those scandals happened. And she's just an amazing person, most progressive social thinker I've ever come across. And she helps women, young women and adult women, in vocational training, giving people options in the third world. It's all about options. and giving people a chance to get out of that cycle of poverty.
It must be very humbling and inspiring, Mick, to interact with these people who basically give their whole lives to this missionary work that is just so remarkable to be undertaken.
It is. They are true humanitarians, mm-hmm. and their sacrifice is amazing. But beyond the sacrifice, Sister Louise, actually, I did an interview, we did a documentary movie in her for T.G. Carr. And I did one of the final interviews I did with her was, now, Sister Louise, you must have known the sacrifice you were making when you were 16 and 17, that you weren't going to have a family, you weren't going to have children, you weren't going to have the things that most women of your age would have looked forward to. She said, I've sacrificed nothing. I'm having a ball.
Wow.
She said, there's not a day goes by that I'm not totally involved with life and with people. Most people my age, she says, are either dead or bored. She said, I'm more alive than I've ever been. Mm. And I had to do a double think. Yeah, maybe in one sense it's a sacrifice, but she leads the most interesting life.
Right.
She's involved in every aspect of running an institution, hands down, there's no ego involved. Mm-hmm. She's just very collegial. And I look at people like Shea Cullen in the Philippines the same way. He said, I had a choice between leading an interesting life or a boring life. He said, I took interesting.
And Mick,
it's not just sacrifice.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that you don't immediately think of. Do you think that someone like yourself who's moved in these circles and travelled around a bit in that work and in your musical work, is there something about the Irish or people of Irish descent that brings them into this or makes them open or well suited to that kind of work, or do you think that that's just navel gazing?
I don't know the answer, because for every case of Sister Louise Horgan, you know, or Father Shea Cullen, there are kids in the Celtic Tiger era of sense of entitlement when they go abroad, all their instinct is going diving in Sulawesi and going caving, you know, somewhere, and they're kind of on a hedonist trip. Maybe it's because the age they are and the sense of entitlement that the Celtic Tiger fostered in people. Having said that, I think we have a long tradition of philanthropy, and per capita, I think we're right up there at the top in terms of giving and generosity to causes abroad. I think it's because we are a victim culture, a colonized people. I think we're very attuned to suffering. Mm-hmm. I think we're very aware of it. And if it's not in our immediate lifetime, it's been there in the immediate past, and we're aware of it. I think, generally speaking, we're probably at the top of the heap when it comes to the food chain of humanitarians.
For you, Mick, I suppose you were at a point in your life that you had the space and energy and you wanted to give back.
Well, I did. I'm 70 this year now, and it creeps up in you. God, you think, there must be some mistake, you know. But you get to a point and you realize, God, life's been really good to me. If you're a musician and you're an artist of any kind and you're a teacher, you're really leading a charmed life, you know. And there is that sense, God, I have to give back something. Life's been very good to me. And if you're in the arts, it's wonderful to be able to use the arts to open humanitarian doors.
Mm-hmm.
There is no finer calling, I think. And the sense of fulfillment and satisfaction that I get from the small little victories, like building a recording studio among the Karen refugees on the Thai-Burmese border. They're in lockdown for 50 years, the young people there, nothing to do and nowhere to go. And to go up there and build a recording studio and see them develop that into a modern studio just with their own skills, the kind of fulfillment you would get from just being able to help on the sidelines with that, it's really immeasurable. And I was very fortunate to be able to get backing to form a slum orchestra in the slums of Bangkok, playing classical and folk music. And half the kids have AIDS, they're born with AIDS, their parents are gone, or they're, you know, they're dead, or in prison, who knows, they just went missing. And these kids, that courage they show, that the love of life, the energy they put into every day, it's inspirational. And when you watch a child die of AIDS, I tell you, you don't have much right to complain about anything after that.
Yeah.
It's transformative when you work, and any missionary will tell you that. I mean, it's a calling. In my sense, of course, it came very late in life, and it's not so much a calling as an interest. And I'm very fortunate to be able to come back here to NYU, Luxembourg, Ireland, and teach here one semester a year. But I treasure the time I spend in the third world, and there's something very nice about seeing the direct consequences of an action.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, you're seeing results.
I mean, it's nice to put a check in the mail for UNICEF or for the tsunami relief, but when you're actually there and you spend maybe $5,000 or $6,000 and you see the direct consequence. Like our latest project now is kids are living much longer who were born with AIDS, and they have an adult life that was unexpected. And they're scattered all over Bangkok, and we were able to create a house, a meeting place, rent a place that's very nice, in a nice neighbourhood, where the kids can meet and have seminars. And handling having AIDS, they're filled with shame. Anybody who's got AIDS in a Buddhist country, it's kind of deemed in a strange way that they're responsible for themselves, the whole the kind of distortion of the karma thing. It's a very, very, very distorted view. And so a lot of education has to go on. These kids, their employers have to be contacted that you can't catch AIDS from shaking hands with somebody. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know this here, but the people in other parts of the world don't. And then to have them develop self-pride, to have them take their medication, to have good nutrition, and more important of all, meet together and continue their association. They grew up together in the slums. That's our latest project. Mm-hmm. And we bring music into that as much as we can, the art.
Do musical influences in that part of the world permeate into your music, Mick?
Not so much. When I do concerts, like I did in Burma recently and in Vietnam, we do collaborations with the conservatory musicians there. They do something, we do something, and then we learn some of their stuff. We swap music and they learn some of ours. And when that comes together, especially on national TV, and it always is, it's a validation of their culture, because westernization is omnipresent and it threatens to wipe out the good and the beautiful in terms of art just about everywhere. So when there's that validation from the visitor, it's like in our own culture when the Clancy Brothers made it big in New York here, people at home say, well, it can't be that bad, I suppose, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. It's the kind of post-colonial thing, but in this particular case, it's not just post-colonial, it's just globalization
yeah.
and the destruction of weak traditions, you know, in favor of the monoculture of the West, really. And so it's a validation for both of us.
Wonderful. That brings us nicely, Mick. We have a tradition, the Tradfest event, coming up in the next few weeks with you here at Luxman Ireland House. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Tony DeMarco, the great fiddle player, the very colourful fiddle player, plays magnificently. He'd be known more of a Sligo style fiddler, though he plays much more than that. And he had the idea last year of organising a trad festival here in New York, and it's not too far from here. And asked him, would I be involved in it? I said I would, and he said, how about having something at Luxman Ireland House to kind of have a reflective dimension to it? There's going to be great sessions and great concerts and that. And what we've had is the second year having a panel discussion on the great masters of Irish music and dance in New York. And this year we're having one of the young Turks, Dylan Foley, who won the All-Ireland fiddle title just a couple of months ago.
Wow.
Last month. And he's a magnificent fiddler. I took him to Vietnam with me when he was 20, and he's great crack and a magnificent fiddle player. And Donnie Golden, who's like the Dean of Irish Dancing in America, and Donnie won the National Heritage Award, and he would be best known as in Ireland as the teacher of Gene Butler, Butler's teachers. And Gene's teaching, of course, mm-hmm. here this fall as well. And Joni Madden, who's, I suppose, one of the most colourful character in Irish music today, I think. And Joni leads the group Cherish the Ladies, mm-hmm. which really has been to the vanguard of highlighting women in Irish music for the last 25 years. And it'll be a bit of a yarn. We'll sit around and we'll chat. And there'll be a bit of a structure to it. But we'll basically have an old chat about the music and dance traditions in New York.
So that's Saturday the 18th?
It's Saturday the 18th at 1 o'clock. And yeah. we'll go on till about maybe 2:30 or so or 3. And then we'll go to the session up at Lily's.
Great. Well, listen, Mick, thanks for taking time out to talk to me this morning. It's great to hear what you've been working on. I know we'll be looking forward to seeing that book ready for publication and going to press. And hopefully we'll have you in again soon to have a chat about
it. It's a pleasure. It's great that you have the radio program now.
Yeah.
That's a new departure, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to people like you and for listeners tuning in to us to have the opportunity to hear what goes on here at Ireland House. Thanks,
yeah.
Mick.
Great. You're welcome.
We've had a lot of talk about Jim Sheridan today as part of our highlighting of Irish Film New York and the Jim Sheridan retrospective that's taking place today as part of that annual event. Jim Sheridan leads me to the next archival leap I'm going to make, going back into what we have done here at Luxman Ireland House in the recent past. In May of this year, we had the pleasure of hosting Sebastian Barry, the well-known, acclaimed Irish author here. Some of you might ask, what's the link with Jim Sheridan? Well, currently, Jim Sheridan is in pre-production for the film Secret Scripture, the award-winning bestseller by Sebastian Barry. It's being made into a film. Jim Sheridan will direct, and I know I, for one, am really looking forward to seeing what Jim will do in terms of bringing that great story to life. So I'm going to take the opportunity now for us to listen to Sebastian Barry's last visit to us here at Luxman Ireland House in May. This is the audio from that event, another fantastic event here at One Washington Mews. Sit back and enjoy this, folks.
Good evening. You're very welcome to Ireland House. I'm John Waters, Director of Studies in the Academic Program here. It's a delight to see such a full house on a beautiful spring evening for an event that I know certainly I'm keenly anticipating. When Sebastian last read here too, a similarly good-looking, intelligent, calm audience so far, at least. But at that moment, it became quite clear to me that because I had to spend a bit of time not only with the books that we were launching, but the books that had come before, that we were experiencing a long wave in the work of an artist whose power seems to be mounting in ways that sometimes you think that's just marvelous and cheerful and happy, but it's also kind of astonishing and powerful. And I think that's certainly the case with the ways in which Sebastian has taken the magic he's put into his first major novel, The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty, and has spun that across the fiction that he's written since. No fiction writer only, Sebastian Barry. He's a playwright of extraordinary distinction and quite almost obnoxious productivity, if I could look around at some of theirs. This is also one of the things, when you look around at an Ireland's House audience and you see the other fiction writers in town come in, then you know actually that something good is happening. Something very important is being welcomed here. The temporary gentleman is here today. This is it. I got a copy yesterday. I'm not the man I should be because I've only waded into it. I have not yet finished it, but I can tell you that the sentences are as chiseled, the paragraphs are as finely wrought and as clearly envisioned from the beginning to the end as we've come to expect from Sebastian Barry, a stylist who knows what he's doing and knows how to treat his readers. Extraordinarily important, that fact. Sebastian writes about Sligo, where my people are from, and where I think there's a few of us in the room who have our roots in Sligo. And it's a remarkable thing to be able to take a small part of the world and bring it out to the world in the way that Sebastian Barry does. I know that you'll join me in welcoming Sebastian Barry to Ireland.
Well, this is my favorite place on earth to read. Not hard to see why. I'm going to read you chapter one, and if I have to say too much about it to you, then we're already doomed, aren't we? Because you're supposed to not need to know anything. But the whole book is written by the redoubtable and complicated Jack McNulty in Accra in 1957, just as Ghana has gained its independence. And I think he's looking for a little bit of that himself, some way of surviving maybe the vicissitudes of his own life and be an independent man. So he's writing his book to see if he can meet himself in the book, and having equipped himself with that knowledge of himself, maybe go on from there. And that's what he's doing. But he begins the book with a description of the first time he approached the coast of Ghana, which was then, of course, the Gold Coast in the Second World War. He's already got his temporary commission in the British Army because he's a very good engineer. And he's 37, which in army terms used to be called an old man. And so, therefore, the consequence of that is the title, the temporary gentleman, because that was the nickname for those guys. Sadly, for you, I'm going to try... I was going to say try to sing the epigraph of the book, but I think slaughter the epigraph might be close. It's terribly hard to sing. I don't know why I didn't choose some nice ballad, but anyway. There we go. When I am laid, I'm laid in ash. May my wrongs create no trouble, no trouble in thy breast. It's a beautiful night and no mistake. You would never think there was a war somewhere. These less than prophetic words were spoken by a young Navy second lieutenant on the wide, night-bedarkened deck of our supply ship bound for Accra. He was a chubby little man whom the day sun had scorched red. Happy to hear an Irish accent, I asked him where he was from, and he said, with that special enthusiasm Irish people reserve for each other when they accidentally meet abroad, Donegal. We talked then about Bundoran in the summer, where my father had often brought his band. It was a pleasure to shoot the breeze with him for a few moments as the engines growled on deep below. The cargo was 800 men and officers, all headed for various parts of British Africa. There was the noise of the little parliaments of the card players and the impromptu music halls of the whiskey drinkers. And true enough, a lovely mole grey air
moved across the ship in a beneficent way. We could see the coast of Africa lying out along a minutely fidgeting shoreline. The only illuminations were the merry lights of the ship and the somber philosophical lights of God above. Otherwise, the land ahead was favored only by darkness, a confident brushstroke of a rich black ink. I had been in an excellent mood for days, having picked the winner of the Middle Park Stakes at Nottingham. Every so often, I stuck a hand in my right pocket and jingled part of my winnings in the shape of a few half-crowns. The rest of it was inserted into an inside pocket of my uniform, a fold of lovely, crisp, white banknotes. I'd get up to Nottingham on a brief furlough, having been given a length of time not quite long enough to justify the long trek across England and Ireland to Sligo. France had fallen to Hitler, and suddenly, bizarrely, colonies like the Gold Coast were surrounded by the new enemy, the forces of the Vichy French. No one knew what was going to happen, but we were being shunted down quickly to be in place to blow bridges, burst canals, and break up roads if the need arose. We had heard the colonial regiments were being swelled by new recruits, thousands of Gold Coast men rushing to defend the Empire. I suppose this was when Tom Quay, though of course I didn't know him then, joined up. So, I was standing there, flushed with my winnings, not thinking of much, as always somewhat intoxicated by being at sea, somewhat in love with an unknown coastline, and the intriguing country lying in behind. I had also about a bottle of Scotch whiskey in me, though I stood rooted as a tree for all that. It was a moment of simple exhilaration. My red hair, the self-same red hair that had first brought me to the attention of May, for it was not I who said hello to her first, but she, with her playful question in the simple, neat quadrangle of the university, I suppose you put a colour in that. My red hair was brushed flat back from my forehead, my second lieutenant's cap holding it down like a pocklet. My cheeks had been shaved by my Batman Percy Welsh. My underclothes were starched. My trousers were creased. My shoes were signalling back brightly to the moon. When suddenly, the whole port side of the ship seemed to go up, right in front of my eyes, an enormous gush and geyser of water, a shuddering explosion, an ear-numbing rip of metallic noise, and a vast red cornet of flames the size of the torch on the Statue of Liberty. The young second lieutenant from Donegal was suddenly as dead as one of those porpoises you will see washed up on the beach at Enniscrone after a storm, on the deck beside me, felled by a jagged missile of stray metal. Men came tearing up from below, the doorways oozing them out as if so much boiling molasses. There were cries and questions, even as the gigantic fountain of displaced water collapsed and found the deck and hammered us flat there as if we were blobs of dough. Two of my sappers were trying to peel me back up from the deck, itself splintered and cratered from the force, and now other stray bits of the ship rained down, clattering and banging and boasting and killing. "That was a fucking torpedo," said my sergeant, with perfect redundancy, a little man called Ned Johns from Cornwall, the most knowledgeable man for a fuse I ever worked with. He probably knew the make and poundage of the torpedo, but if he did, he didn't say. The next second, the huge ship started to pitch to port, and before I could grab him, Ned Johns went off sliding down the new slope and smashing into the rail, gathered himself, stood up, looked back at me, and then was wrenched across the rail and out of view. I knew we were hole deep under the waterline. I could more or less feel it in my body. Something vital torn out of the ship echoed in the pit of my stomach. Some mischief done deep, deep in some engine room or cargo hold. My other helper, Johnny Fats Talbot, a man so lean you could have used him for spare wire, as poor Ned Johns once said, in truth was using me now as a kind of bollard. But that was no good, because the ship seemed to make a delayed reaction to its wound, and shuddered upward, the ship's rail rearing up 10 feet in a bizarre and impossible movement, catching poor Johnny completely off guard, since he had been bracing himself against a force from the other direction, and off he went behind me, pulling the trouser leg off my uniform as he did so, sending my precious half-crowns firing in every direction. So for a moment of odd calm I stood there, one leg bare to the world, my cap still in place inexplicably, myself drenched so thoroughly I felt 100% seawater. An iron ladder full of men from God knows where, maybe even from inside the ship or from the side of the command deck more likely, with about a dozen calling and screaming persons clinging to it like forest monkeys, moved past me as if it were a trolley being wheeled by the demon of this attack, and crossed the ravaged deck and pitched down into the moiling dark sea behind. Everything roared for that moment. The high night of blankening stars, the great and immaculate silver serving dish of the sea itself, the rendered ship, the offended and ruined men. And then, precipitately, a silence reigned, the shortest reign of any silence in the empires of silence. The whole vista, the far-off coast, the deck, the sea, was as still for a moment as a painting, as if someone had just painted it all in the studio and was gazing at it, contemplating it, reaching out to put a finishing touch on it, of smoke, of fire, of blood, of water. And then I felt the whole ship leave me, sink under my boots so suddenly that there was for that second a gap between me and it, so that wasn't I like an angel, a winged man suspended. Then gravity broke the spell. Gravity ruined the bloody illusion, and I went miserably and roaringly downward with the ship. The deck broke into the waters. It smashed through the sacred waters like a child breaks an ice puddle in a Sligo winter. It made a noise like that, of something solid, something icy breaking. Glass, really, but not glass. Infinitely soft and receiving water. The deeps, the dreaded deeps. The reason why fishermen never learn to swim. Let the waters take us quickly. Let there be no thrashing and hoping and swimming now. Let your limbs go, be calm. Put your trust in God. Pray quick to your Redeemer, and I did. Just like an errant fisherman, and give up my soul to God, and sent my last signal of love flying back across Europe to May. May and my children, up the night filthy coast of Africa, across the Canaries, across the old boot of England, and the ancient baby shape of Ireland. I sent her my last word of love. I love thee, May. I am sorry. The ocean crows over my head with his iron will, and the fantastical shock of the sinking ship drew me down as if 100 demons were yanking on my legs. Down, down we went, our handsome troop ship made in Belfast. The loose bodies of the already drowned, the myriad papers and plans for war, the tins of sardines we had taken in Algiers, the fabulous materiel, the brand new trucks, the stocks of tires, the 53 horses, the wooden stakes, the planks, the boxes of carefully stored explosives. All down, down to Neptune we went, extinguished in a moment without either glory or cowardice. An action of the gods, of queer physics, that huge metal mass, sucker punched, beaten, ruined, wrecked, fucked to all hell, as Ned Johns would say, and I felt the water all around as if I were in the body of a physical creature, as if this were its blood, and the scientifically explainable forces at work were its sinews and muscles, and it stopped my mouth and found the secret worm whorls of my ears, and it wanted entry into me. But I had grabbed, stolen, fetched out with an instinct of exuberance, a last great gulp of breath, and I was bearing this down with me, in my chest, around my heart, as my singing response. My ears were now thundering with the thunders of the sea. I thought I could hear the ship itself cry out in a crazy vocabulary of pain, as if a man could learn this lingo somewhere, the tearing death cries of a vessel. All the while, as if standing on the deck, but that was not possible. And then I thought the ship was turning sideways, like a giant in its bed, and I had no choice to go with it. I was like a salmon looking for the stream in a waterfall, where it could grip its way to the gravel beds on grips of mere water. And now I thought I was rushing over the side, away from the deck, accelerated by some unknown force, faster than the ship itself. And I was scraping along metal. I felt long seagrass and barnacles. Surely I could not, but I thought I did. And just as the ship went right over, or so I imagined it, how could I know, in the deepest dark, the darkest, deepest dark that ever was, an instance of utter blankness, suddenly I felt the very key of the troop ship something wide and round and good, the sacred keel, the foundation of the sailor's hope, the guarantor of his sleep between watches, but all up the wrong way, in the wrong place, violently torn from its proper place, and just in that moment, with a great groan, a weir, a menacing sighing, a sort of silence as the worst noise in creation, the keel halted, and went back the other way, at the spine of a whale, as if the ship were now fish. And because I was holding onto the keel, riding it like a fly on a saddle, it sort of threw me back up the other way, catapulted me slowly, Mr. Cannonball himself in the Tuppenny Circus of old and Venice grown, my childhood flaring in my head, my whole life flaring, and then I seemed to be in the shrouds of the little forward mast, and I squeezed my body into a tight ball, again pure instinct, not a thought in my head. And as the kill ship rolled slowly over, seeking its doom at least in a balletic and beautiful curve, the furled sails rolled me over and over, giving me strange speed, volition unknown, and I unfolded myself like a lover rising victorious from the marriage bed, and I spread my arms, and I thrust them into the ocean, and swam, looking for the surface, praying for it, gone a mile beyond mere breathlessness, ready to grow gills to survive this. And then it was there, the utterly simple sky, God's bare lights in the serene harbours of the constellations. And I grabbed like a greedy child onto something, a shard of something, a ruined and precious fragment. And there I floated, gripping on, half mad, for a minute without memory. Oh, may, for a minute all absence and presence, a creature blanked out and destroyed, a creature bizarrely renewed. By the grace of God, we were travelling in convoy that night, and by the grace of God, for some reason only known to its captain and its crouching sailors, the submarine melted off into the deeps, not that any of us saw. A corvette, bristling with machine guns, manoeuvred up near me. I heard the confident voices with wild gratitude. Arms reached down into the darkness for me, pulled me from the chaos, and I slumped, suddenly lumpish and exhausted, at the boots of my rescuers, falling down to lie with other survivors, some with dark blooded wounds, a few entirely naked, clothes sucked off. I lay there, ticking with life, triumphant, terrified. I noticed myself checking my inside pocket for the roll of banknotes, as if watching someone else, as if I were two people, and I laughed at my other self for his foolishness. We steamed into Accra the following morning.
Hard work, you all right?
Yeah, I'm grand now. It's just the shock of being back in New York.
I certainly will.
Hi.
Is there any movement on a film of a long, long way?
Ah, the film world. That delightful and uncertain terrain. At least with books, they give you a publication date, and more likely than not, they probably will publish it on that date. There have been confident reports in the newspapers about two particular films, one of which is The Secret Scripture, and the other A Long, Long Way. But, I mean, I'm not a religious man, but there must be some sort of strange gods attending the arrangements for film, because I don't think I quite understand it. And I could say things to you that would be proven to be graceless but honest lies. I don't know, how do these things come about? So everyone is slaving away to try and make things happen. And sometimes, miraculously, they do. But I'm always very mindful that every waiter in San Francisco is a screenwriter. I think you should hold that thought in your mind. And that's only San Francisco.
In Our Lady of Sligo, how involved were you with the production, or were you involved at all?
In those days, or in them days, which is how the play begins, I can still hear Sinead Cusack's, in them days. This is the hey, the wonderful days when we were working with Max Zaffer Clark for Out of Joint. And this is the original production. And, well, Max prided himself on work. We had done the Stuart of Christendom together, and this was our second play together. And he prided himself on working only with new playwrights, which is a very dangerous and unprofitable thing to be doing. And he liked you to be there every day. And now I would be more questioning of the usefulness of that, because I don't think it's particularly helpful to have the playwright sitting there every day, sometimes looking like this. So, and Sinead did mention that to me afterwards. Because you're there, but you're ready there to accept the changes. You know, brilliant actors like that and Donal, they are testing, they're hitting every line, every phrase, with a very special musical testing instrument and making sure it's ringing true. Because as you know, in the theatre, there is nowhere to hide. You've just, everything has to be right. So I was pretending, I think, that I agreed with what they wanted to do, basically. I don't remember ever suggesting cuts or changes. I do remember panicking when they moved a few sentences around, because then suddenly I need a GPS for my own play. I don't know where I am, and I can't answer the question. So as you can see, I was entirely useless to them in the 5 weeks of the rehearsal, but I was there. And to see the miraculous thing occurring, which is one of the great pleasures of playwriting. And a compensation for what happens when plays don't go quite to plan, where your own mother, you know, will issue an aversion in the newspaper disowning you, your closest friends will cross the road to get to the other side, or even leave the country so they never have to meet you again. Formerly loving critics are now having the time of their life telling everyone how absolutely rotten you are, and they were wrong the last time when they were, you know, so all that stuff, you know. You really need a lot of character to be a playwright, and I have found over this 20 years or 30 years trying to be a deficiency of character in myself. So I tell myself, out of kindness to my own living, breathing being, that I've retired from the theatre. I think at 58 you should retire from something. So I go, so I retire from the theatre. But when it goes right, there's nothing like it, is there? No.
No, nothing.
No. Jeanette, you can't go wrong. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. I read somewhere your work on the Dunn family and the Stuart of Christendom in particular was a way to sort of exercise and confront a controversial moment in your heritage. The Thomas Dunn, the Catholic supporter of the English crown.
Yeah.
I was wondering if your experience of having written them has been satisfactory or successful in that way.
Well, the first time I was here, we had just opened the Stuart of Christendom, which is by Thomas Dunn, in Bath, and lovely, saintly, brilliant, delightful, cherishable Ben Brantley had raved it in the New York Times. But that was the culmination of a very worried young writer in Ireland before I wrote that play. When I discovered I'd had this ancestor who was one of the last chief superintendents of the Dublin Metropolitan Police before independence, who actually, nobody even knew where he was born, he was so covered over, where he was buried, he was so covered over. I was very worried because I thought, well, now I have a sort of traitor in the family, and will anyone find out? So you might think it's a little bit strange that I sought to hide this fact by writing a play that we later opened. But that was the process. But when I started to write about him, because this is one of the troubles of singular histories, and now in Ireland we're writing kind of multiple strand histories, but the singular history of nationalism, which in its own way was very helpful and very life-giving, nevertheless left out a lot and also cancelled out a lot and erased a lot. And maybe at a national level there is a certain argument for that when you're trying to make a new country, but at a familiar level there's never a good consequence of that. So when I started to write the play, the phrase came, you know, Ecce Homo. This was just a man. This was another man who had tried to live a life on this earth. You know, an admirable achievement in itself, as far as I'm concerned. So I wrote the play, and then by extraordinary accident, which is so much part of the theatre I couldn't begin to tell you, Donal McCann, who had been 3 years sober, had worked with Max years before, and Max just sent it to him, and I thought, no, don't do that, that's not going to be. But Donal came and made the great performance of his career in this play. So we ended up having the nicest time of our lives, but the origin of it was fear and dread and dismay on my part. So what that says about what we should be doing with our secrets, I'm not sure. I mean, what I've been doing with secrets, and my mother was the great connoisseur of family secrets, which she would try to reveal at every opportunity, but nevertheless, and there were many secrets. For instance, Jack, the original Jack, let's say the man who lived and breathed, was my grandfather, and a man I worshipped as a child. I had a talent for worship as a child. My two grandfathers I adored. I didn't know my grandmothers. We shared a room in this old mansion in Monkstown that he had bought for £4,000 that was full of tenants. And eventually we got rid of all the tenants. But nevertheless, at one point we were in a room together. And I was in the bed with him, you know. And he'd be telling me stories about the Hindu Kush and the Northwest Frontier. He'd been all over the world. And he'd tell me about Accra and the Gold Coast and people he'd met there and all the things, and he'd fart a bit and he'd say keep the heat in, and it was the perfect atmosphere for a child. It was the ultimate child. Meanwhile, in another part of the house during the daytime, my mother would be telling me another set of stories about him, which was all the stuff he would never say. So I had this kind of stereophonic, symphonic flood of information coming at me in the bed and then somewhere else, and you know, she blamed him and prioritized her mother and all the rest of it. I just grew up with this wonderful but frightening sometimes stories, a miasma of stories, a tsunami of stories. And the fact that this man in his previous existence, not as a grandfather, had been in the British Army in the Ireland of that time in the 70s, when, you know, just after the North conflagrated, it was very uncomfortable, and I didn't quite understand why he'd done that, and I didn't understand. I kind of thought it was foolish, I think, when I was young. It's only now, years later, when you see that, you know, there is a multiplicity of experiences, and that our motives for doing things are often so fictional. We do absolutely living. We create a living narrative of the things we do based on foundations of pure fiction. And his fictional foundation was so wonderful, and he in himself was so wonderful, that it took me like 25 years after he died to fully appreciate him. What I'm saying is that though I might have feared aspects of him and was ashamed of him in some way, now I just think, although there was a lovely review in The Guardian that said, this is the first book that's narrated by the bad guy. Although it was a lovely review, I just remember, I thought, Jesus, I hope he's not reading The Guardian.
On a lighter side,
yes.
I
that was my light side.
I mean, so much, certainly not very literary, but I do like your technique of assigning the F word to what's the name?
Yes.
And you continue that throughout. I just got the book, so you have, and I haven't seen that in many of your other books.
I reserved it. I kept it back. Well, a long, long way, the book about an invented great uncle who went to the First World War has some pretty, you know, soldier's language. And one or two people complained and said, that's not right, because soldiers would never curse. So I felt I had to actually do that for that, because that's, you're talking about language then. You may find other instances, but that might be the only two. Strangely enough, the use of the word, it's actually a rather lovely question, because as you can imagine, if you're a man in his late 60s and your grandson suddenly starts to write about you, as I did in the 70s, it's a deeply uncomfortable feeling. Let me not allow you to think that he was thrilled. He wasn't in any way thrilled. Now, although he had been a soldier, and a really wonderful soldier, I have to say, he was very successful as a soldier. He ended up as major, as a Royal Engineers. He had 2 terms of bomb disposal in England, you know. I was so longing when the Queen came over to Ireland to tell her about this wonderful Irishman who was defusing bombs in England. what a welcome change, man. But I, you know, she had paid me no heed and moved on to Mary Penn recently. One of my cousins is here, so. But so I'm worried about saying anything. But anyway, I wrote this story, and it was about him and me when I was small going to see his mother's house in Sligo. Again, people I worshipped unreservedly. And I described in the story the smell of boiling mutton in the house, which is what was in the house. He took the gravest exception because he loved his mother and he felt it like it was a social critique of his of the household. And he called me round to his flat, appropriately enough on Appian Way in Dublin, 22 Appian Way if you're ever passing, give him a wave. And for the first time in his life, this man, although he'd been a soldier, was a beautiful speaker, beautiful writer, beautiful teller of stories, never used a curse word in my hearing in all the years we were in bed together, you might say. And he said, how do you know these things, you fucker? And I was so offended. I mean, I had no idea what I'd done. I'd been in Paris writing these stories. It was nothing to do with anything except the syntax, the force of a story, the thrill of being 22 writing stories in a Chambre de Bonne. I thought he'd be delighted to see these salmon I'd brought back from the dark Moy River, you know, my own fish. But no, you, and that's the only time. And I was so offended. I've said that before and I've seen it reported sort of backwards. As if we never spoke again until he died, which was 3 or 4 years later. Because I was so stupid and so young that I thought everything was forever. And I thought he would always be there. And he said at some point, let's make it up. And I refused. Which was really dreadful. By way of recompense, though you might agree if you read The Guardian, I have thought about him, you know, every day of my life. And I revere him as the guardian angel of my childhood, as the man who did that sacred thing. He saw the child enmeshed, embroiled in their own mess of childhood, in their generation. And when he was going west to Sligo, right across the island, he threw the child in the Ford Cortina and brought me with him. This is the task of the grandparent. Let us not forget. Throw the child in the car when you're going west. Can't go wrong.
Please join me in thanking Sebastian.
Well, thank you.
Before I sign off for another week, folks, I'd like to draw your attention to the book launch taking place here on the NYU campus on Tuesday night, October 7th at 7 p.m. Lethal Allies, I mentioned it earlier, authored by Anne Cadwallader. We're very much looking forward to having Anne Cadwallader on campus, and she will be talking about her new best-selling book, Lethal Allies, which looks at collusion between the police, British soldiers and loyalist killers in the murders of over 120 Catholic civilians in the conflict in Ireland. This event is open to the public free of charge and will take place at 19 West 4th Street, room 101. If you're interested in more information, call Sean Downs on 212-248-3232. And Anne will be here with Alan Brecknell of the Pat Finucane Centre, and we're delighted to have them here on campus to discuss some of the events surrounding the research for this project and what takes place at the Pat Finucane Centre. We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time. If you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, please email ireland.house@nyu.edu or call telephone 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Stanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.